All right, we're starting on a hole that is a par four, shooting out of a nice protected little nook over a little grassy fairway with one tree to miss. You can miss the tree on the right. You can miss the tree on the left. Some players choose to just go right through it because that's disc golf. Into a landing zone that if you get it far enough, you're on top of the slope, but often you'll find yourself kind of on an uphill slope on your second shot. Second shot, you're looking over a bit of a water hazard. Water hazard all the way on the left as well, approaching into a green that is guarded by medium-sized trees. The green is sloped pretty significantly from right to left, funneling down to the water.
Hole two at Idlewild.
Hole two at Idlewild is correct.
Wow.
He did it. Eagle is destroying the intro game and taking a demanding lead, I'm guessing, because we're not keeping score.
I have good memories of that hole.
Somebody go back across all the episode and comment on this episode what the score is, because I have no idea.
Yeah, Eagle has a famous Eagle. Famous Eagle hole.
Yeah, that was a magical day. I threw in for Eagle. I was on chase card, and then I went on to win the tournament. Yeah, that was a fun day looking back. And hole two at Idlewild, that's kind of a tricky hole in all honesty. Like, you want to get a birdie, obviously, but that green is very sloped.
It is, yeah. The landing zone can be tricky too, unless you get it all the way up there. Lots of people do go forehand. I usually go backhand and just aim at the tree and hope I don't hit it. The classic.
Well, welcome our little Scoville units. This is
boy.
Crushed Pepper episode 10. This is pre-Waco, and Joey is already in Waco. Simon is not in Waco, and I will not be going to Waco. But we got a good show lined up for you guys. I think, do we have a Simon Wines this episode?
Simon Wines!
We definitely can. I have plenty of options left, so.
I want to hear some whining. Joey has some unsolicited advice, and I don't necessarily have anything because I woke up not too long ago, and we got to get this recorded amidst my busy week getting my van ready and doing my last little bit of tinkering back home before I'm out on tour.
What is your departure date, and how long of a drive is it going to be to Austin?
We are recording this on Monday. I am going to be driving out on Wednesday, getting into the Austin area either Thursday evening or Friday morning, and going to stay with my friend Jesse Chisholm, who actually owns a Wagyu farm, which is going to be very,
what?
Very tasty.
What?
Yeah. Shout out Jesse. He's sent me some of his prized Wagyu beef. And my goodness, it's some of the best beef I have ever eaten in my life.
Are you going to bring some to the Waco week?
I'll see what I can do.
I'll pay.
It's next level, this stuff. It is so unbelievable.
We had an amazing steak night in Florida, and Schlebach is coming to both Texas events. And we talked. I actually kept the charcoal in my roof box because I bought a bag and we only used half of the first one, and I have a whole another one left. So we decided that we thought it would be a little excessive to try to do two in 2 weeks, basically, because they're pretty big productions. Obviously, I don't mind either way, but we essentially thought of Austin as our next steak dinner. So my question for you is, can we buy from Jesse, or is he a limited seller?
I'm gonna see what he can do. I think there's a high chance, but these are some crazy good cows. Like they, he has certifications for them that trace all the way back to Japanese origin, and his cows literally have won awards for like the best beef around. And
is he a disc golfer?
He is a disc golfer. Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm going to his place. I'm going to spend about 1 to 2 nights over with him. So I'll see what kind of beef he has.
How do you get?
Have you told us yet why you're skipping Waco? Is there a reason or?
There are plenty of reasons why I'm skipping Waco.
One, do you want to say?
You want me to say? Waco is probably my least favorite course on tour. And that is not a stab at any of the Pro Tour guys. Ryan Draper, I love Ryan. They put on a great show, but I just didn't want to play it. I wanted to prioritize my happiness, and I just decided, you know, I don't want to play a back-to-back either this early in the season, because if I played Waco, then I'd have to practice 2 courses in 3 days going into Austin. And just historically, I want to ease myself into the season and condition myself. And Waco was just not something that I personally wanted to subject myself to. And I thought long and hard about it, and I decided, you know what? I'm not doing it.
So do you guys know? I feel like both of you guys historically do not play well at this tournament. Do you know off the top of your heads what your top finish at Waco is over the years?
Technically, I played Texas States there back in 2016, and I got 2nd. And then my best finish at Waco was 6th.
Oh, that's better than I expected. Simon?
Yeah, the first year we played Waco, I don't remember what year it was. Could have been 2015. I think I got 5th or 6th as well. But back then, there was like, that was obviously pre-Pro Tour. And the field was like, getting 6th was basically worst case scenario. I have lost my mind on that course. I have lost my confidence on that course so many times. I actually used to have a reminder set in my phone that said, do not go back to Waco. Just because we all know the off season is long. And you start craving competition. You start craving disc golf again. And you might get some silly ideas that you do want to go back to play that course. And I used to set myself a reminder to bring me back to reality that I do not want to go and play that course. But
I always get
this year,
terrible poison ivy there for whatever reason.
Oh, there's multiple reasons why I have I have had horrible experiences during the Waco week. It's just, I don't know, 1 year it like fell onto like March Madness or something. And like the whole town was booked out. Every hotel was booked out. They had no rental cars. And I was just scrambling to even get around that entire week. And I like way overpaid for like a crappy hotel that week. And I just felt like, ugh. And then I played like crap on the in the tournament as well. Last year I missed, I think it was my only missed cut ever in my life. I didn't make the cut. I didn't play on Sunday last year. So at least this year they don't have a cut.
Oh my gosh, I remember that.
Yeah, on Sunday I went to play a vlog round with Paul Kranz to get rid of our sorrows. Like, yeah, I don't know what it is, because that course technically should suit me. There's 9 fairly open holes. It does get a bit windy, but they're not like the hardest holes ever. There's some OB to deal with, but they're all fair. And then the little wooded holes are little like, almost like pitch and putt, like Massachusetts style, just technical little, some putter shots, some mid shots, a couple of trickier ones, hole 9, personally, that long par 4. Is it 9 or 10? That long par 4 down the tunnel? 9.
9.
I despise that hole, mainly because it causes crazy backups, and I just think it's so unnecessary and just stupid. Anyway, so there's many reasons why I've never really had a good time there, but this year I'm going in with a new, fresh mindset, and my whole theme, because we're doing daily vlogs, of course, again, of the week, was overcoming my fear of the beast. That's going to be my theme of the week, and we'll see how it goes. I'm intrigued.
It is so funny that you guys have that kind of shared attitude, and I could not be more opposite. Waco,
I'm not
going to
name
favorite
names, but there's a lot of other people like us on tour too.
Oh, for sure, no, for sure. But and I think it's a classic course that it's like
before
it should
you before you
birdieable.
Say this, I want to make it straight for the record. My favorite part about Waco is the short, quirky wooded holes. I don't like the open holes, to be quite honest. That's what always tears me apart coming down the stretch. But also, it's just, I don't know. It's just, there's not an energetic match for me in that course for whatever reason. Maybe I'll go back one day, but as of now, I am very happy that I am going to be camping at Palo Duro State Park in Amarillo, Texas, as well as spending some quality time with my friend Jesse Chisholm, going to watch my other friend do a DJ set, going to Barton Springs and practicing Sprinkle Valley and Harvey Pinnock before anyone else.
Well, Bradley beat that you sounds, to it, but yes.
That's right. I want to say one controversial thing about the Beast. It might be one of the few courses on tour that I would actually, if I lived there, go and play for fun. Because for casual, fun disc golf, it's actually a really cool course, especially the wooded section. It's like so enjoyable. But for some reason, in competition, when you're playing for like thousands of dollars, it's just so on the fluky side. And the things we've had to watch in past years there of people just absolutely shredding it and sometimes just getting so lucky through the branches, through the trees, it just, yeah, it messes with your mind. And I don't know. It's one of those courses that is so easy that when you start slow, your mind just instantly starts spiraling that you're already so far back, you can't catch up because, I mean, the field is so strong now that if you shoot a good round there, let's say like an 8 or 9 under, that feels like, oh yeah, I did well, I didn't really blow up on any holes, solid. Someone's going to shoot 13 or 14 every single day. And it just feels like sometimes there's no winning because someone's just going to completely murder that course every round. So, yeah, I don't know.
That's
it's a discouraging track on tour, in my opinion.
It's just funny for me because it is so the opposite for me. Waco is my favorite course on tour. It's my favorite stop on tour. And there's a couple of reasons for this. Number one, it was almost always my first glimpse of spring every year because we used to start out on the west and it was just the desert. So yeah, it was warm, but it was dry. And I don't know, I'm not really a big Vegas or Phoenix guy, to be quite honest. It doesn't really do that much for me. So coming to Texas was always like this, oh, this breath of fresh air, like there's the green grass. And I love the wooded. I wish that Waco was just 18 of those wooded holes. Like I wish we just played 18
of those. I'd
probably
play it if that was the case.
Yeah. And not just that, but I love how cute this little town is. It's like a city and it has everything that you need, all the stores that you need. But it's also like traversable in 15 minutes from one end to the other. It's got a little beautiful, not little, a big university, Baylor. So it's got a huge kind of youth, hippie, kind of progressive, colorful section to it that I think results in a pretty cool downtown. And I love the course across the river. William Cameron is probably one of my favorite non-tour courses. Like the courses that are nearby to the ones that we play, William Cameron is, I mean, those wooded holes are just as fun and exciting for me as the holes at the Beast. And it was the first course when I was 18 years old on tour that I played a lot. I didn't really play Vista the first time. Waco, that first year in 2019, I probably played like 5 or 6 times. And it was the first course that I thought to myself that maybe I could one year be like a solid pro disc golfer because it gave me some confidence on some of those holes. And I've just always loved it. And outside of PCS Open, it is my best event, like average in 2021. I think I got 50th and I averaged like 10-10 or 10-15 for that event. And I think it was definitely my only round of that year that all three rounds were 1,000 rated. And I always just love the wooded section because it reminds me of home. And I have a really fun little Waco story that I wanted to tell you guys about Steve Dodge and me. So this is 2019. In this year, I was 18 and I was in charge of setting up all the course assets. So all the walls and the basket pyramids and basically anything. It's not as much as it is now, but I was the only ops guy back then. And so I would show up probably 5 or 6 days before the event, set up all the assets, and then film. And this was the first event that I was asked to film because they realized that this little 18-year-old guy was going to be a lot cheaper than contracted cameramen. And while contracted cameramen are probably better general cameramen, following discs with an action camera is actually a slightly acquired skill that even a high-level cameraman might not kind of pick up right away. And I had just been watching discs fly my whole life. And I had a bit of the kind of predictive filming, which is kind of what you have when you're a T-cam. You have to be able to see the people on the tee, see the disc that they're holding, see the line that they're looking, and you guess. I mean, you do guess. And if you talk to other sports cameramen, like especially the catch cam guys in ball golf, I mean, they are totally doing predictive zooming. And I actually just watched a video yesterday where the golfer shanked the shot, and you can see the camera guy just totally miss it because he was expecting it to go straight up in the air, and it was like a stinger, and he caught on and filmed it perfectly. But for that reason specifically, I was essentially given the nod to do roaming cam. So I just like walked around and filmed whoever was hot the first day. And then on the second day, Steve said, Joey, you know disc golf well, pick a foursome and go film them. And if they play bad, then, you know, go find somebody else. But if they keep playing good, just keep filming them. So naturally, I picked Paul McBeth because Paul McBeth was my favorite player of all time. And I wanted to go watch him, and he was on third card, so it was like a good, it was justifiable. So I was like, I'm going to go film Paul McBeth, and Paul McBeth shot 18 down that day. One of the craziest rounds I've ever seen, ever, and I filmed every single shot of it, and it was ridiculous. And so that was that whole weekend, and then we get to Sunday afternoon. Steve and I worked until dark. So Steve would always show up usually a day or two before the event, and he would help me break down the course afterwards. And so Monday comes around and we had an off week. And so I said, Steve, if we kick butt and we break this down, we could play this afternoon, you and me. And I had played probably 5 or 6 rounds with my full bag. And I was like, dude, I'm going to kick his ass. Like, this guy's got no chance. And Steve's like, yeah, we can play. So we kicked butt, broke the whole course down. It's probably 3:30. And I'm like, all right, you ready? He's like, yeah, let's do this. So he goes into the back of the Pro Tour trailer, lifts up like a couple of random boxes and finds this like half folded Chally SS like under this box. He like bends it back to straight, kind of feels it. He's like, okay, this will work. And then as we're walking to hole one, he looks at me and he's like, man, I should probably not just have a putter. I think I need like one more thing. And so we're like walking just conveniently right past the DD guys who are breaking down their stuff, and he looks at Taco, Ryan Shitaku, and it says, do you have like a 7-speed, like something flippy? And he goes, oh yeah, we just came out with the Maverick. And Steve's like, great, hands him $10, takes a Maverick. So he's got 2 discs. And I don't know, Simon, you probably know this. Eagle, I don't know if you know this. Steve throws standstill backhand only. No run up, nothing. So Steve is in these like cargo khaki shorts with like a button up and 2 discs. And I am just licking my chops like, dude, this guy's going to eat it. This man shoots 7 down bogey free from the longs with 2 discs throwing standstill only. It is maybe one of the most frustrating rounds I have ever played. I could not believe my eyes. He birdied so many stupid holes with 2 discs, especially 2 discs he had never thrown before. It was one of the most impressive disc golf performances I've ever seen.
At some point, maybe when we're all in Massachusetts, we should try to get Steve Dodge as a special guest.
Yeah, he would be a good guest.
He's like a second father to you, Joey, right?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. He taught me so much about everything on the road. I mean, I would say a lot of the guys that were a bit older than me that took me under their wing, Craig Stenzel and Jack Dallywater, did a lot of the same stuff for me. But yeah, Steve was the first who really kind of showed me the ropes. And yeah, I mean, I was a kind of wear my heart on my sleeve extrovert kid who didn't really, you know what was going on, but definitely got himself into some situations. And Steve was always there to steer me in the right direction. And I'm always forever grateful for the time that I got to spend with him. And it's funny looking back on it now because it was so brief. I mean, it ended up only being like 7 or 8 months now out of the 7 years that I've toured. Back then, it felt like I was going to be seeing him every week. And now I see him once a year. So I'm just so grateful that I got to overlap with him and just see both sides of it. Because yes, like, the Pro Tour is in a great spot now that he is no longer running it, but it would have never gotten anywhere. It wouldn't have even started without Steve. I mean, do you guys know the reason, like the whole backstory of the beginning of the Pro Tour?
Maybe.
Kind of, sort of.
I mean, Steve was on the board of directors for the PDGA, and he was trying to expand the national tour because he was seeing, you know, how much it was benefiting the pros. And he just essentially kept pushing that idea that this should be more than just like a 5 or 6 event series. And they essentially, you know, they listened and expanded it to whatever it ended up being. But eventually they kind of stopped and they were like, we're not going more. Like, we can't be investing all our resources into the pro side. We have to represent all disc golfers. And we can't just essentially suck all of our treasury money out and invest it into this thing that may or may not work. And so Steve left the board and started the Pro Tour. And it's basically because of that. And it was with the help of Nate Heinold, who signed on, and Jeff Spring, who signed on, and guys who committed events right off the bat. And I mean, it was ragtag. It was, Steve did everything for us in 2019. I mean, he was editing the ads. He was our CEO, negotiating with everyone. He was the marshal on the course, making the rulings. He was cooking everybody breakfast. He had like all his special, he used to have these little pieces of bread and he would cut a little fried egg sized hole in it and then do the fried egg.
So Texas One Eye.
Uh-huh. And Steve was, I mean, he did everything. It was crazy. And it was a family affair. I mean, his brother Todd, who is a longtime flight attendant, would come
out.
Still is. And he would come out, I mean, every event. And it was me on throw and Todd on catch, or Todd on reaction. And then, I mean, Steve's mom came out at a few events on the East Coast, and his daughters came out, and I got to meet his whole family. And it was a totally like a family affair back then. And it was just, I mean, he put his heart and soul into that company, and I'm so grateful that, you know, it's still going and he gets to see the continued progress.
The nostalgia is hitting me because I played the early Pro Tour events that were A and B tiers, and it's kind of like you had to be there to feel what it was like. Like, now it almost feels like this novel time, almost kind of like disc golf Woodstock in a weird kind of way.
Oh, for sure.
And
for sure.
And, you know, it was crazy because the national tour back then was the elite series. It was equivalent to what we're playing now. And the Pro Tour was kind of this new thing we're dipping our toe into. And we're like, oh, you know, this is kind of cool. They did some things better than the national tour. And after a while, like, I felt like most of the players were starting to lean more towards the Pro Tour and the way Steve was setting it all up. And they were adhering to his vision, and it's just crazy to think how far we've come since then, which is wild. And now you have the Go Throw Tour that actually just happened this past weekend, and I just think it's great to have multiple tour options. You have the Tour Down Under in New Zealand. I really like that disc golf is growing to where you have an option now. Like, what tour do you want to play on? What do you want to supplement with when you're playing the actual Elite Series Tour? I think we're in a very exciting place for disc golf, and I won't be surprised if even more tours come out soon.
I mean, it was the closest that I felt to that kind of ragtag nostalgia tour feel was in 2023 when I went with Paul to every stop on the PGA Euro Tour. That I was going up to every event and seeing the like Matej Vairel and Calixto and all those guys busting their butts, and there was like three of them and Kimo. And I remember telling Paul, like, dude, this feels like 2018, 2019 Pro Tour. And he looked around, he's like, dude, it totally does. Cause it was just the same thing, the starting of a new tour, and it was ragtag. And I don't think you'll see that as much anymore in the Euro Tour. I think it quickly became very sophisticated. But that one year in 2023 felt very nostalgic back to those days.
This is a good segue. What do you guys think about the GoThro Tour? Did you keep up with it at all?
I watched the scores on UDisc. I think it's great. I think that at first I wasn't sure.
Are they all two-day events?
That's a good question. I have no idea.
I think they might be, which I think is really cool, in all honesty.
Is it that because then Friday is the skins? Is that the
I think Friday's
idea?
Friday skins.
That makes sense.
I think they kind of know their place right now. They know that they're the secondary tour to the Disc Golf Pro Tour. And in the off weeks, to have a little rephrase that. Maybe not little, but a tournament that is non-sanctioned, two-rounder, where a lot of players can get on coverage who might not normally get on coverage and just play without strings attached for PDGA ratings, I think is a really cool idea. Just the way the tour's set up, I think I'm going to be able to play maybe two or three of them. I'd like to play more, but as a lot of people know, I value my off weeks just for rest and rehabilitation, but I really like what they're doing. Paul Omen and Luke Humphreys on the mic, that's one of my favorite commentary duos. It kind of reminds me of old school Central Coast, very calm and relaxed. Makes me feel like I'm watching some good old fashioned Frolf again. And first round I watched, it was terrible conditions. It was so muddy. Like there was one hole where they were just showing Gannon and Niklas trying to walk down a hill, and they were moving so slowly because the mud was so terrible. And I thought it was entertaining. It was entertaining to watch, but I know if I was there, it would have been like, oh, this is rough. James Conrad had to do short run-ups the entire round, which...
Did you see Niklas's, like, 65-footer in the middle of the mud pit where he had so much mud on his shoes that
he couldn't even kick
his back foot? Yeah, he couldn't even kick his back foot out. But the thing I love, too, is that it's unsanctioned, so there's enough cash on the line that it's still serious competition, but the unsanctioned nature of it, I think, is absolutely like bringing more pros in every week. And I mean, I love the GK guys now GoThro. I remember I met them when Blaine worked for them at one of their first events that they filmed, which, Eagle, you were there too. This was the 2019
Oklahoma Open
Nick Hyde Memorial. And it was,
speaking of muddy,
I think it was like on my, maybe it was on my birthday or it was on your birthday, somebody's birthday. And I live scored your card that first day, at Nick Hyde, because we were just passing through on our way to Jonesboro. And that was the day that I met those guys.
Nick Hyde, that place brings back some good memories.
Like, yeah.
Looking back, Harry Myers, it wasn't like the greatest course in the world, but I'd always go there coming from Colorado. It's kind of like you in Waco. They're just like a nostalgia aspect of that place.
Mm-hmm.
Like I know we always used to stay with the Olivas, Don Oliva, Maria, Cynthia, their dog Dixie. And it was just like, it was such a fun time. There was a great pho place down there. Like, I always made an effort to go play. Simon's a Nick Hyde champion. I think I won it in 2019, and that's a place where I have some very fond memories of. I miss the old Harry Myers course. But yeah, GoThro. It's cool to see them doing their thing.
But you're right. I looked on their website. It's all two-round invitational tournaments this year. So just, I think it's great. I think it's awesome. I think that it's exactly the supplemental thing that we want as pros who, and I think also it's to be noted that this year there are significantly more off weeks on tour than there was last year. I feel like, personally, I feel like the
there's probably
intensity,
like four to six less pro tour events potentially.
Yep. And I think that that's a really good thing. I think that that's something that shouldn't go unnoticed. I was starting to feel like the schedule was getting to a spot where players were risking injury with the amount of events they were being asked to play, or at least based on how the point structure was working. And I was starting to essentially get into a spot where I was just like, I don't know how many more increases we can do here.
I think at this point, every top player is burdened by some sort of nagging injury.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. We move on completely, just a shout out to Gannon Burr for taking down the first event by 2 strokes over Emerson Keith, 3 strokes over Raven Newsome. It was actually pretty close coming down the stretch. Everybody in that top three had a chance. And in FPO, Cat Merch taking the win with a really nice final round, beating Rebecca Cox by 5. So those are your first two champions on the Go Throw Tour. And I think that is a perfect segue into some whining.
Yeah, I want to hear some whining.
I want to hear some whining.
Cue the jingle.
Simon whines. Hey, Simon whines.
Go get them Simon whines.
We already kind of whined about Waco.
We did. So I'm going to whine about lifeguards in America.
Oh, this is interesting.
I obviously grew up in Germany, where lifeguards are also a thing. But usually when you go to like a public pool in Germany, the lifeguards have one spot where they just sit and kind of look over the pools. There's cameras. They have like an overview of what's going on, and they can make announcements, and they can, you know, do all the lifeguard things you got to do. And yes, I do think lifeguards are important, and I'm sure they save plenty of lives every year. But I think there is a way to do it and a way not to do it. And at the Pro Tour Championships last season, I stayed leading up to the event a couple days. For the first time, I went to a place called the Great Wolf Lodge, which, if you're American, you probably know of these. It's kind of like a chain of like indoor water parks with hotel and restaurants, and basically like a kid's paradise for all things water slides and fun and all those things. And what the lifeguards were doing there blew my mind. I don't know if you guys have experience with this, but basically it's like a choreography. That's a word, right?
Yep.
So these lifeguards nonstop walk up and down the pools from one side to the next and move their neck in like a choreographed way from up to down, from right to left. And they do this the entire time, walking back and forth and constantly moving their head left to right, up to down, scanning the water the entire time. And it is to a point where you can tell it's so locked in and robotic that I feel like they would do a better job watching if they would not be stuck in this constant movement where, first of all, how the hell is your neck going to survive that for longer than 1 minute? Like, it just looks so painful. It's like constant. They're walking and turning their head the entire time, nonstop. And you can just look into their eyes and see they're not even looking anymore because it's so automatic. Like, it just looks like, it almost looks like they're like slaves walking up and down this pool, being told they have to move their head constantly to make it look like they're looking. And I was watching this and I couldn't stop staring at them because I was like, what is this? Like, how is this scientifically the best way to make sure the people in the pool are safe? Like, it just seemed so surreal and crazy. Like, I thought I was stuck in like some horror film. I couldn't believe it. It was so over the top, in my opinion. But okay. And I have another one more story I had. We went to, every year we go to Smuggler's Notch, of course. That's in Vermont where the tournament is. And they also have outdoor pools. And at the time of year we go to this place, it is not really in season. So I go with my family, with my toddler. And we were the only ones in this pool, in this entire pool area. The only family was us. And I wanted to take Emmett down the little kids slide, which is like a maybe 20-foot slide into the little pool. And of course, they have to have a lifeguard there because that's their job. And the lifeguard told me that I'm not allowed to go down the slide with my son. And I'm just like, why? And he was like, well, that's just our policy. And he has to go alone. I'm like, but he's like, he doesn't want to go alone. He wants to go with his dad. And he said, sorry, no, we were the only ones there, but whatever. Okay, I was fine with that part. And then they also have a big slide for grown-ups where me and my wife wanted to go try it. But for us to be allowed to go down the slide, there has to be a lifeguard at the top of the slide and a lifeguard at the bottom of the slide. Again, we are the only ones there. And basically they said, oh yeah, we're understaffed right now, so you can't use the slide because we can't have someone watching from the top and from the bottom. And I'm just holding my head like, you cannot be serious. Like this is, it's like, I understand that you have rules and I understand the point of this, but like common sense has to kick in at some point. Like we're literally the only ones there. And it's just weird when you're playing.
You're going to get stuck at the top of the slide.
I mean, I was in like a kiddie little pool with my son. We're the only ones in this entire freaking resort. And we have one lifeguard sitting right there staring at us the entire time because that's his job. And I'm just like, wow, this is crazy. And just the way I grew up and where I grew up, I just was not used to anything like this. And I didn't really understand why those safety guidelines in America are so over the top. And I mean, it seemed crazy to me, like completely unnecessary and a waste of money. But then again, who knows? I mean, what do I know? Probably. But I just wrote it down as a thing that it blew my mind. Can you guys explain like what's going on in American pools where they're just so unbelievably over the top with their lifeguards?
No, I think that's a very valid whining session.
Okay, good.
That sounds all pretty preposterous in my opinion. Of course, I don't know what's going on in lifeguard culture. Maybe it's completely valid, but it doesn't sound like it.
I've never heard of the first one, personally. I've never seen that in my life. The four-way head movement, I've never heard of that at all.
The closest...
I just thought of one more story. One more quick one before you keep... Sorry. Again, at the Great Wolf Lodge, at the bottom of one slide, I asked the lifeguard who was sitting there, like scanning the bottom side of the slide, if I could take my son, if my son was old enough or big enough to go down the slide. And there was no one in this pool, no one going down the slide. We were like the only one standing there next to him. And he said, oh, I can't really look at your son right now because his job was to scan the pool at all times, even though there was no one in it. And I was right next to him with Emmett, like literally standing a foot from him saying, hey, is my son big enough to go on down the slide? And he told me, sorry, I can't look. And
he can't look to check to see if your son was big enough.
Correct. I mean, their guidelines and their rules must be so unbelievably strict and hardcore. I mean, probably for a reason, I guess. Lives are on the line at the end of the day, if you really break it down.
But sounds like they're just scaring these poor lifeguards into like not even bending with the rules. Now, I'm a type of person where I would probably lose some of my jobs that I had if I had 9-to-5s, because I agree with Simon. Like when common sense applies, like it would trump my like whatever I had been taught, like in that situation, right? It's like I'm not gonna, if there's obviously nobody in the pool, I don't care like how much I had been scared by my boss. Like I'm going to be like a human being first. And I'm sure that would probably cost me some employment opportunities. But like, I see your point, Simon. Basically, these people are so scared to lose their job that they like literally won't be a human to you. They're just going to like, they're more important to like not break any of the rules of their work that they won't even do what seems to be like a standard.
It sounds like they're guarding you from the life you're meant to live.
Oh.
There's probably a good reason behind these rules and restrictions and jobs, but...
The closest a lifeguard's ever...
In Germany, it's so different.
The closest a lifeguard's ever got to saving my life was at the Louisville Rec Center when I was about to get in the pool with nobody in it. And they said, don't go in there. Someone pooped in that pool.
That's a lifesaver.
That was a lifesaver. So, I mean, shout out all the lifeguards out there.
My sister, she was a lifeguard at our local pool for probably like 4 or 5 years. And my biggest like whine about lifeguards at those pools, I don't know if they do this in Germany, but in the U.S., whatever, at these big outdoor pools, I'm sure it's at indoor water parks too. Maybe it's every hour and a half, they do the safety break. Dude. And I know this is not a real valid whine because the safety break actually makes sense. Like, get everybody out so everybody can go look. I hated that. I thought it was so stupid. I was just like, what the heck? The pool is right here. Why do you need to take 25 minutes to make sure that there's nobody? You can tell within the first 30 seconds whether or not there's somebody left in the pool. Like, get everybody out, look around. All right, good. All right, go back to swimming. And I just like, when I was 8, 9, 10, I just could not wrap my head around the fact that I had to stop my fun for 20 minutes so that all these people who worked there could go look in all these spots. And I just felt like it could have been done a lot faster. Do you guys have safety breaks in Germany too? Is that a thing?
No.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm moving.
I mean, yeah, last year in the European Open, I stayed in a hotel that had like an indoor water park as well. And I was paying attention to what the lifeguards were doing there. And they're just sitting in their little room at the top of the pool.
Oh, at Scandic. Scandic Nokia.
They have cameras. Huh?
At Scandic Nokia?
Scandic Eden, it's called. Really cool. Really cool little hotel. Great breakfast buffet, and they have a disc golf course right outside the front door, so it's pretty fun.
European breakfasts are, if people are used to the American continental breakfast and then go to Europe, it's insane the breakfast spread that they put forth. It's so much fun. It's like an unbelievable amount of food, and it's all really good.
Yeah, that hotel had ratatouille.
Ratatouille for breakfast? Wow.
Like, okay, that's a bit over the top, maybe.
Yep. I stayed at that hotel in 2023 for the European Open. It was a very nice experience. And yeah, that little 9-hole course, absolutely at no point during the day was there.
It's 6 holes.
Or 6? Yeah, you're right. Yeah. There was no point during the day that it didn't have at least 3 to 4 groups playing on it at all times.
Oh,
it's packed.
Last year, I probably played like 20 rounds there, and it was packed at all times, even at like 10 p.m. It's still bright out at 10 p.m., but it's still packed with kids. It's like, it's pretty wild.
Well, that was a great wine, Simon.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly enjoyed it. It made total sense to whine about.
Yeah, what they should do is have signs at the front of the pool saying, enter the pool at your own risk. And then, of course, have lifeguards there for emergencies. I think that's very important. But, I mean, within reason, I think, is the key.
I mean, yeah. If they're going to be that cautious for you around a pool, shouldn't we have people, like, on all the highways just, like, sitting there on their little towers watching everything, you know, blowing a whistle if somebody makes, like, a wrong turn? I mean, at the end of the day, essentially, I think the strictness of all of this in the U.S. is to prevent lawsuits. It's just all legal. I mean, it's just for these big water parks to cover their own ass so that they can say that basically they did everything. They did every precaution. They were following every standard. And it's just all, none of it feels humane. It's literally all a money thing. It's just to prevent lawsuits. Mm-hmm. And I feel like suing people is less common in Europe, maybe.
I feel like lifeguards on beaches are a very good thing in general. I think
Oh, yeah.
Because
life cars in general are a good thing. Don't get
yeah.
me wrong. They're a good thing. But, I mean, those at Great Wolf Lodge, they look dead in their eyes.
Right.
Like robots walking up and down the pool. And I'm like, this is counterproductive, literally less safe than if you just put someone on a chair with, like, a nice view of the whole pool. Like, it blew my mind. Yeah. Whatever. Eagle, what were you saying? Sorry.
I was just saying that having a lifeguard on a beach is almost completely necessary because the ocean's a wild place with the different currents and
Riptide.
The vastness of it, riptides. So,
and the animals.
Animals, too. Like, a lot can go wrong in the ocean. So I'm sure that a beach lifeguard is probably trained a little bit differently and is, dare I say,
probably have to
more
be like
capable.
Insane swimmers.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Well,
that's a good name for the episode, lifeguards.
I think like a soulless lifeguard or robotic lifeguard. Well,
we'll find a good name.
Just to quickly preview the week ahead, we've got the Waco Annual Charity Open. This year, it is only 3 rounds. We are not playing the golf course. We're playing 3 rounds at Brazos East. Starting on Friday, the course is changed a bit. We eliminated the new hole from last year, the Hyzer 16 over the water.
Oh, that, thank God that hole was horrible.
That
Holy
hole,
cow.
That hole is gone, and they brought the hole that they took away back. So the hole 15, the one that...
They brought it back?
Yep, it's the same.
No.
Yeah, that's the trade-off.
No, they did not.
That's the trade-off. So, and they have they've changed it a bit, or at least they went back to even a earlier version of it. So now the inside of that metal fencing is all out of bounds.
So it's a par 4?
Nope, it's a par 3. It's just like it's like if you want to go for it, you can birdie it. Otherwise, you're going to throw like 300 or 300
looks like he doesn't want to go.
Basically, you're gonna throw just two little chop forehands.
God.
Or this is something that my good friend Eli Swanson noticed yesterday. So this is really interesting about that little section is that whole fence line is that it's not a fence line. It's whatever that little metal. I guess it's a fence, but it goes flush to the right side to the actual fence line on the out of bounds on the right side, but it doesn't go all the way to the road. So there's that little strip where you usually walk. So that's safe. If you landed there, you would be in bounds and safe. So that's the hole that they brought back, essentially. And then the next hole, 16, they also changed. So now it's a very specific two-shot par 4. The hole is identical. They just essentially made this huge OB pinch point that's like essentially... at its skinniest, maybe 15 feet wide. So now, if you want to go for it, you have to get inside circle 2 to be safe, or you throw essentially like a chip 330 hyzer and then another shot. So it turns it into a much more risk reward. I actually like that
change
personally.
So it's like a little pinch point and then it bubbles out.
Bubbles back out to circle 2.
So that big cottonwood tree on the right side.
Yep. That would be
that's
out of bounds,
safe.
Barely. It's barely out of bounds.
So you're thinking people might play just like a little chip mid-range or a fairway driver?
Yes, I think almost everybody is, except for the guys who are confident they can put it in the air in circle 2.
So who approves this stuff? Like oh my God. Maybe I need to take over this position of approving course decisions because it's so painful. They took away one of the funnest tee shots that the fans enjoy to watch because we can freaking just send one. It's one of the only holes on the course where we can send one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a cool little eagle chance. And if you get a 2 on that hole, that was like such a cool thing.
Scoring low is bad, Simon. Eagles are bad for disc golf.
I think they have PTSD.
So
I think that course specifically has PTSD, though, because, I mean, as we remember, not just the course, but the pars on that course have changed a lot. I mean, we have lost... 9 and 12 used to both be par 5s when we started this tournament. And those are both now par 4s. And that 18 down that Macbeth shot was, a lot of people argue it's because of the eagles that he was able
to
get.
What would that 18 be on a modern day Waco? Would it be like 14 or 15?
13 or 14, probably.
Yeah, I mean,
which
I
will
think,
be
no, maybe 13.
Which will
well,
be shot.
And 18, was a par 4. 18 was a par 4. I mean, it might be 12 even, like, because he got.
And 15 was a par 4.
Yep. Those are all right. So it's
two par 5s. I think.
And the par 5s.
8 and 10?
9 and 12.
Or 9 and 12. Those
nine
are par
5s. Yep, those are par 4s now. And then 18 and 15 are both par 3s.
The funny thing is like, it kind of doesn't matter.
No.
Because it's the same course, more or less, just a different score.
But now they've actually changed the course,
par
right?
Par matters.
So now they've par actually matters. Changed the course. I would say more frustrating to me than that is back to our conversation about chess.com of Supreme Flight. I always say chess.com. Supreme Flight last week about the little Twizzlers. Man, Simon, if you had an issue with that last week, just wait. There are some courses where I wish I could just be given free reign.
What's
a
Twizzler?
A Clipper. A Twizzler? You don't know what a Twizzler is?
But what are you saying, the little Twizzler? Twizzler branch?
Yeah, that's what Yuli calls them from Jomez days. He calls them little Twizzlers. And that's what I started calling them because I did so many Jomez commentary sessions with those guys. That's what he called them. But I wish that Jeff Spring would just let me take a set of Clippers to that course because there is so many little freaking twigs. And I love Waco to death, but there is so much luck or bad luck on the fringes of a lot of these fairways that could be really cleaned up, in my opinion. And I am almost excited to watch Simon's face as we get through some of these holes in the practice round on Wednesday, just because I know I'm going to relate to him so well.
My dad and our friend Dave designed a little course it's a modified course at Valmont. Dave Batch.
Oh, and shout out Dave Batch.
It's so funny the way they talk about it because obviously the course already exists and they get so excited talking about it. And it just made me think that course designers just take so much pride in their own course. And I think for good reason, but they almost become blind to certain things. And they themselves like these quirky holes. They don't see these Twizzlers as a bad thing. They see them as challenge, and that's why they don't get cut down. And to take them down, it would almost make their whole community frustrated, because I'm sure people who are listening to this who are from Waco, they're a fan of these like hanging branches, these vines that are in the way, because if for the purists out there, if you hit that branch, they'll say that shot wasn't good enough. You deserve to hit that branch.
We had a comment on our last episode saying, if you don't want to hit the twigs, don't throw at the twigs. And
exactly.
No, the problem is not that you can hit the twigs and your shot gets ruined. That's not even the problem with them. The problem is that two discs going at these twigs will get
different results.
90% of the time, a completely different result. Like, one will just go right through the freaking branch and be parked. And then you throw the same shot. And you just hit the twig a millimeter different, and your shot gets derailed and like shoots into the stuff where you suddenly are facing a bogey. Like, it's just,
I have a theory.
It's just random. That's the problem. It's random.
Everybody has a low key desire to gamble. And I think disc golf really exposes that for a lot of people. And I think that's what we're doing, because some of the holes that we play, we're literally gambling by throwing the shot. Like, is it going to land on red or black? And it could be rolling, it's going to roll on black, and then it just falls over to red. And that's no different than so many courses we play. The shot's going right down the fairway, it's looking perfect, kicks way off course, and then somebody right next to you throws a shot that's an inch to the right, perfect result.
Did you see Brad's video from Sprinkle Valley like 2 days ago? It's exactly what you just said. So there's
really?
a new MPO long tee, and I guess it's hard to tell in the video, but obviously he thinks it's a luck, like a 50-50. So he turns to the camera and he goes, this hole I call the birdie or bogey hole. I'm going to flip my disc. If it lands tails, I'm getting a bogey. If it lands heads, I'm getting a birdie. And he flips it and it lands like tails. He goes, all right, cool, bogey. And he just chucks it. And you can see this tiny little skinny gap. And he just like drills one of the trees and he goes, yep, there it is. And he's like, it's literally a coin toss.
I want to see like an alternate universe. Say AB on hole four at Olympus. If his second shot, some reason, doesn't hit that one tree and kicks out of bounds and he's able to save a par, that day could go so much different for AB.
Yep.
And it's literally, his day was an inch away from being completely different. Potentially
from being
winning
a win.
The tournament.
Back-to-back champ.
Some days, yep. And it comes down to, some days, it's just your day. Like, no matter what you do, you're going to get through the tree. The light's going to shine gloriously on your face, and you're going to be like, man, I love this game.
Speaking of loving this game, I played Team Challenge this weekend.
Oh, hey. Wow.
So you did go because you didn't have to because you were already qualified for finals.
Correct. I didn't have to go, but you know, when I'm home and when it's not raining or just terrible conditions, then I'll play. It was predicted to be windy, and I thought, oh, it won't be that bad. But we played Buffenville Dam, which is a very exposed to the wind course. It's right next to a big lake, and most of the holes are pretty open. So I thought, whatever. It was going to be like just above freezing, so like 33, 34 degrees, sunshine, and windy. And get to the course, and it wasn't that bad round one, but the wind was predicted to get worse and worse. I think round one was like gusts up to 20 miles an hour, which, you know, it's significant, but not like ruin your day significant. And then halftime break, where we always get like the big buffet, the home team cooks and serves for the away team. Great food as always, but it was so windy at this point that you like couldn't hold your plate properly because the wind was like just like whipping it in your hand, and it was hard to control your food that wouldn't fly. And I mean, the real feel of what the temperature was because of the wind must have felt like 20 degrees tops. Like, it was so cold, the wind was just piercing your, like, I couldn't feel my nose at this point, and it was miserable. And I was so contemplating to cancel round two and just say, hey team, because we had to sit two players in round two anyway because we were more players than the other team had. So it wouldn't have like really changed anything, obviously, minus that I'm playing versus someone else is playing. And I was like, oh, I just want to go home, take a warm shower. I had like plans in the evening as well, but basically my team called me out and say I would be like a wimp if I quit just because of the wind and the cold. So, you know, I thought, I'll rough it out. It can't be that bad. I sat in my car for like 30 minutes trying to warm up. And oh my God, did I regret playing that second round. It was like the wind gusts were like hard to stand straight at some points. Like, it was so windy. Like, we all know at some point if it's so windy, like, disc golf is not disc golf anymore. You're kind of just tossing your disc and watch what happens because there's no way you can control what's going to happen. It was so cold. Like, I have really nice warm mittens, and the wind pierced through the mittens that my hands started getting cold. And I think, I mean, the reason I play Team Series is, of course, one, for fun and the community. But for the other, it's practice. And practicing competition rounds, I mean, that's valuable practice. You don't really get that all the time. So I tried to get some competition practice in and like take it seriously and try my best. But I think this kind of practice is almost a negative effect to your game, because I feel like I was losing confidence. I mean, a 15 footer was 50-50 if you would make it or not, because it was so windy and it was so cold that it was just like pointless. And I feel like that day I was at injury risk because my body was so cold and nothing felt natural. I lost confidence on the putting green because it was just felt unpredictable. So that was my team challenge weekend. My team still won, so at least that was a positive.
Is it, who are your, is it Marky Chap and Casey on your team?
Yeah, we have a very strong team. We're leading the league. We're on route to the championships. Finals are next month. And I think we have the bye. So we only have to play two rounds.
From what I understand, there's a second Buffenville team. And from what I understand, you guys haven't beaten them in the last like two or three seasons, from what Casey told me. I didn't realize that you could have two teams, but then he started telling me about Buff 2, which is it Paul Kranz and Harry Chase and
David Fleck?
Yeah.
I think.
Seems like a really...
Yeah, very...
I didn't know you could have two teams.
Buff 2 is very good.
Yeah, they're like one of... Aren't they... I mean, it's crazy that one... It would be like having Manchester have two Manchester. I guess they have City and United, but it's like...
Do they have Deion Sanders as their coach? The Buffaloes?
Buff 1, Buff 2.
Well, here's another thing that sucked that day was that they double booked that day. Team Buff 2 also had a match that day on the same course. So it was packed, and round 2 took like 3.5 hours in the freezing wind.
Eagle, have you played
Buff? Double booked.
Have you played Buffenville, Bird?
I have not played the Buff.
I have. I went there once and played, and I played with Cal, and it was very windy, and that, what is it, like 14 maybe, the one that you go like back over the dam? That was a crazy shot,
yeah,
because
15.
Of the way the... It feels like because of the way that the wind like comes into that and like shoots up, it almost felt like there is this like huge like updraft. Like I would throw these shots. I threw like 3 or 4 and they'd go perfectly normal. And the moment they crossed out over that dam, they just go straight up like 30 feet, just ripping straight upwards. And I just felt like that was like a pretty calm day, like maybe 15 mile an hour winds. And I can only imagine the gusts that exist after that.
That's one of
that.
The cooler holes. This course has some cool holes. It has a good mix of short technical and some long open. But damn, in the cold wind, ugh. No, thank you. Not again. But I repped through it. The shower felt afterwards just so much better. So yeah, that was my disc golf weekend. I'm happy I still threw, because if I don't throw for more than a week, I tend to get a bit sore if I go throw again. So I had to go throw regardless. It was just two rounds in one day is just, man, that's Simon from 20 years ago, maybe.
I mean, I agree with your point, though, about like, at what point is it so windy that it's not even helpful? And I think the only, and it's you could say the same with rain. And I think the only way that those are useful is simply showing you how bad it can get and like seeing if you're, it's like that, that point it's mental.
If you don't understand the basics of playing in rain and the wind, then it can be beneficial for all the, say, advanced level or lower MPO level players. Like you need to understand how the wind works.
I mean,
but
I
once
have
you
a,
do,
yeah,
then it's probably best not to play in it very often.
I have a very, very, very memorable round that I actually played with Casey White, of all people, in Minnesota in November. It was a B-tier, a two-round B-tier at the Preserve, the Haunting at the Preserve, and the first, I mean, it was three rounds, but it was the final round, and it was me and Casey White and I think Aiden Guthrie, throwback.
Shout out Aiden.
Shout out Aiden, another team member, a teammate of ours. He's been on Team MVP longer than any of us.
Give me your dimension, son.
Oh my gosh. I already asked him. He said he's not letting any of those go.
He's not getting nothing off of him.
No, he gave me one disc. He gave me tempo, I think, and maybe a couple others. But this round was, I would say, sustained winds of 35 miles an hour with gusts up to 55 or 60. Let's just say this. I didn't run a single putt outside of 18 feet. I laid up every single putt, and I think I shot like 5 or 6 over, and it was like 985 rated. And of the entire 100-person field, or like 80, there was 2 people who shot under par that day on the Preserve, like easy layout, not the one that we play for the Pro Tour, like a course that like I would be expecting myself on a bad day to shoot like 3 under. And Kale shot 7 under, which was like 1070 rated, and Eli. Eli was the only other guy to shoot under par. Everybody else shot even or way worse. And I asked Cale afterwards, like, sort of frustrated, like, why are you just ruining all our ratings? And he was just like, dude, I didn't run a single putt outside of 15 feet. I laid up everything. And Casey, everybody started doing it. I mean, on our card, I remember at the beginning, like, nobody wants to, like, be seen doing that. So you, like, run one or two. And, I mean, you run a 20-footer, and all of a sudden, you're 60 feet away. And Casey, right off the bat, you could tell, like, what you're saying. I just didn't have that kind of, like, conceding kind of in my head of, like, I'm going to have to play a different game. And right off, like, on hole one, Casey was laying up putts that he knew he shouldn't be running, and he shot even, which was the best score on our card. And I caught on, like, two or three holes later, but by that point, I was already, like, six over. So I managed to kind of, like, maintain after that. But it's like you said, I mean, he right away, he knew what this was going to be, what kind of round it was going to be, and he completely switched his game plan. And so that's, like, the spots where I see it being beneficial. But even like Simon was saying, I feel the same way in the cold, that I almost, like, put myself at a bit of an injury risk. My elbow always seems to be kind of mad when I play in the cold, even if I do, like, all my warm-ups. So I essentially avoid playing basically any winter rounds all winter for that reason mainly.
Next off season, I'm going to make an effort to either go down under, go to Florida or somewhere warm for probably a month before the season starts, just to get the disc golf game sharp again, but also use it as a conditioning opportunity to really see what your discs do. Because playing here in Colorado in the cold, you're not getting zero benefit, but you're not getting all the benefit of playing somewhere where your discs have the natural warm feel, the flex, and the way your body feels on a majority of the year. And I think Joey can kind of speak to that as well as Simon. It's a completely different game playing when it's warm, or even like above 50 degrees. Because we very rarely play any rounds lower than 50 degrees all year.
Yep. I agree.
Should we wrap this up with a quick advice? Or
I have an unsolicited advice, and then Joey has his, we have the standings.
Yep.
For our fantasy. So,
oh, okay.
Let me take it away with just a quick unsolicited advice. I want to shine light on a YouTube channel that I discovered probably at this point a year ago that's absolutely amazing. If any of you guys have wanted to get into breath work, this channel called Breath Work with Sandy is absolutely incredible. He has anywhere from like 5 to 30-minute breath work sessions where he'll guide you on, you want to get into a more meditative and relaxed state, or if you're looking for energy to start your day, or a little bit of a pick-me-up. He has everything in between those two options, and I do it every single day, and it helps me relieve my anxiety. It helps me get energized in the morning, or if I'm feeling a little jacked up, it can calm myself down at night. If people are familiar with the Wim Hof breathing, it's somewhat similar to that. I mean, he has so many different videos that it's basically what are you in the mood for? What is your goal? Are you trying to regulate your parasympathetic nervous system and get into a rest and digest state? Or are you trying to pump up your adrenaline to start a round of a disc golf tournament? So that's my unsolicited advice, Breath Work with Sandy. I absolutely love the channel. He does a really good job. It's a very polished look, very, very lucrative if you're a disc golfer or if you have any sort of anxiety. It really helps me out on a day-to-day basis.
All right. Well, I will quickly give us the standings after the first event. Bringing up the rear, this is for fantasy disc golf for anyone who's just wondering.
It was two episodes where we had our picks, right? Was
mm-hmm. it two or three episodes ago? Two or three
I think it was
ago.
Two episodes.
No, it was three because two ago was the live.
Yeah, it was two yep. ago. Yeah.
Three. So we have three MPO, three FPO, and after the first event, we have Joey in third place with 407.7 combined points. My team consists of Missy, Kristen, Isaac, Niklas, Ella, and Anthony, famously having
rough
dropped Ezra.
For that weekend.
I dropped Ezra. Now, I'm happy because Ella won and AB got second, and I still feel good because Niklas didn't have his best week and Kristen wasn't there. So the fact that I still managed to get 407 points, I feel okay with. But that is third place by a significant margin. In second place, Team Eagle, consisting of Gannon, Owen, Eagle himself, Paul Macbeth, Cat Merch, and Paige Pierce with 503 points.
Did you mention Gannon?
Yep. Okay. Gannon, Owen, Eagle, Paul, Cat, and Paige Pierce. And then leading the way, Team Simon, consisting of Ricky Wysocki, Holland Hanley, Calvin Heimberg, Evelina, Simon, and Silva Sardinen with 616.83, a commanding 113-point lead over Eagle and 199-point lead over Joey. So I'm excited to see how these go. Honestly, I'm still feeling good about my team. So
we all got good teams. So it'll be fun to see how it plays out over the course of the year.
Well, what's the name of this boy before we sign off?
Something lifeguards.
It's a perfect name.
Something lifeguards.
I don't really have one right now. Nothing stood out to me. Do you guys give me something?
Something lifeguards.
I liked soulless lifeguards, and then I also liked Waco whining.
There we go. Waco whining.
Well, you
thanks
little
for listening.
Scoville units. Eagle, I think that's great. I loved that.
You like Scoville units?
I loved that. You little okay. Scoville units out there, thank you so much for listening. Also, just wanted to appreciate the support in spite of the slightly different release schedule that we've had on tour. Our goal is obviously to go every Wednesday, but you know what? We have lives, okay? We travel a lot. We have things that come up. We are definitely making an effort to keep that on schedule, but appreciate the support nonetheless. And we hope to see you in the next episode when we're all back together in the ATX.
Together again. We'll be going live from the ranch in Austin.
I'll be in Waco tomorrow. Let's go.
Woo! All right, you guys.
Peace. Thanks for listening.
Peace.
One second. I'll be back. You talk about team challenge.
Okay. Bye.
I'm back.